This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, the Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World. Whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points north and south, east and west, where we're either rebroadcast or live streamed at www.kbf.org or www.acornradio.org. A podcast will be available of this show on these websites and affiliatedmediamovement.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today we're talking to Sean Bailey from Glasgow, Scotland, who is the organizer who directs the program for something called Living Rent in Glasgow. Welcome to Wade's World, Sean.
Thank you, Wade. Pleasure to be here.
That's exactly right. Well, I want to apologize for my accent, and, you know, good luck with Sean's. He and I are, you know, working on English-to-English translation most of the day. I've been actually Sean's translator most of the day, and then right before we did this interview, whoa, one just went flying by me. You know, I don't know, it was like a two-worder. Maybe I needed more sentences, or more in the sentence, but I still don't know what you said, but it was okay. It was like, I'm not too busy for this interview, right, or something.
Yeah, it was along those lines.
Yeah, he told me go fly a kite in Scottish, but I, you know, didn't get it, so I didn't fly. Anyway, Sean has been doing critically important work on a housing crisis in Glasgow. Give us some background for people who've never been to Glasgow or have no idea what's happening in Scotland.
I'll certainly try.
Okay, fair enough.
So Glasgow is the biggest city in Scotland. It was traditionally the most industrial city. It was one of those cities in the British Isles that competed against each other for the infamous title of the second city of the British Empire. So Glasgow and its surrounding area was the most industrialised area of the world at one point. Obviously, as the world changes over years, industry changes, the economy changes, alongside that, housing options and housing stocks changes drastically. So to move forward maybe 100 years, the Glasgow City Council at one time had 80% housing stock was owned publicly, owned by the council, the kind of local authority. That has now dropped to below 40%.
So in US terms, that would be public housing?
Yeah.
Social housing? Social okay. Housing. And now that housing stock is being diminished radically?
Yeah, so the local authority sold off their entire housing stock to semi-privatised bodies, housing associations. They still maintain the social housing, but within that, the amount that was sold off has been halved again also. There's also, in the 70s and 80s, there was a conservative policy called right to buy your council home or your state home. That has seen two-thirds of all properties since 1970 sold through right to buy are now on the private sector market.
And was that ideology, or they were going broke and had to have the money? What drove something so crazy as trying to do that?
Without a doubt, in my opinion, it was ideology.
Uh-huh.
It's been proven since that state housing or public housing actually turned a profit for local authorities, and it helped to maintain other public services. Like I said earlier, the way the economy is changing, particularly in the UK and across maybe the Western world, They're looking for new markets to exploit, and when you had such a high density of public housing, it strangled the market of profit for many people, so they've sought out to destroy
private housing. Okay. And so in this sort of flip over to private housing, so that gave landlords sort of the whip hand then?
Absolutely. The balance of power is still firmly in the kind of hands of the landlord. We've achieved a great deal recently, but it's the imbalance of power. What we're seeing is, particularly in the UK, wage stagnation that's lasted the longest time since, I think someone said, Napoleon was basically running about Europe. So
Napoleon?
Aye, so Napoleon times. This is the longest wage stagnation ever since, but it's also the highest living costs, particularly housing costs in the UK. So we're seeing a kind of combined effect of wage stagnation, but also kind of not unemployment, but underemployment, they call it, and high living costs. And
we have the same problem in the US, Canada, and other countries. This is a crisis around the world. But so in Glasgow, how much have rents really increased in the last number of years? I'm sure you all must keep up with that.
Absolutely. Well, we're now currently facing the record high, all-time high private sector rents.
They're around maybe £760, I think, just this year. In terms of the cost of living, though, that's if you're a minimum wage worker that's 18 years of age, that's almost 80% of your monthly wage just going in housing costs. But also across the social sector, which traditionally where working class people lived, we've seen massive increase of 55% over the last 7 years.
Wow, and that's huge. But rents are going up all over Scotland, aren't they? Because at one point I heard not only Edinburgh and Glasgow, but Aberdeen had gone through the roof. And most people think, I mean, Aberdeen's way the heck north and oil country or whatever. I don't even know what they do in Aberdeen, but never having been there. But I heard there was even a higher increase in Glasgow. And I know y'all do some work throughout the country.
Yeah, well, Aberdeen, I think, is rising again. But in the last 2 or 3 years, due to the oil price, it had dropped. But even with that drop, it was still considerably higher than both Edinburgh and Glasgow. Traditionally, wow, that was maybe double the price of Glasgow. You're talking maybe over £1,000 at least for an average rent.
So for those listeners in the United States who are listening to this, when Sean says £750, he's really talking about $1,000, yeah, roughly. And so when he talks about £1,000, you're really talking about, you know, $1,300, $1,400. So, and that's average rent. That means a lot of people for decent housing are paying, are being forced to pay way more, aren't they? Or have three roommates and a, you know.
Absolutely. So what we're finding is that we're saying that it's maybe the average rent for a two bedroom flat in a tenement. So Glasgow's built up these kind of tenement flats. But what we're finding is most working class people, if they can't get social housing, are forced to live in an unlawful condition, actually. So, two-bedroom tenement flat, £700, £800 per month, you'll try and sell the living room, or you'll rent the living room, so you'll make another bedroom out of the sitting room, the kind of communal room, and you'll do that unlawfully, I suppose.
Tell me about how that works unlawfully. I mean, is that like taking a roommate? No.
It's not so much subletting.
Somebody off the lease, or how does it work, brother?
Glasgow's, I think Scotland, maybe other places have, they've a kind of homes of multiple occupancy law, and basically that states anyone that's not in the family nucleus, no more than two people can live there unless they have this certificate saying it's allowed. So it's a massive issue in Glasgow where people that are kind of flouting this law, I wouldn't say breaking the law, but they're flouting it, are also too scared to take any action to improve their conditions because they're aware that they are.
They don't have the leverage because they're not on the lease and they could be accused of illegally occupying.
Yeah.
So they're damned if they do and damned if they don't.
Absolutely.
And meanwhile,
absolutely,
they're paying out the butt.
Yep.
Not to be too specific on the radio, we want to keep it where the FCC wants us, but gee, money. So how did you get involved in this, Sean? I know you've been working here and living rent for a year or two at this point. I mean, it seems like longer, but...
It certainly at times feels longer and others it feels if it's flew by. I was briefly involved with Living Rent before, when it was a Living Rent campaign. It was heavily focused on winning certain concessions for a building through the Scottish Parliament. Spent a lot of time working away. When I came back, I was out of work, but I was also looking for a change. So I became more politically inclined, I suppose, and the scene part Living Rent were looking to hire a part-time organiser. I generally thought I wouldn't stand a chance. If I was honest, it was not something that was in my background at all. Worked as an electrician, worked in Afghanistan doing defence for the Americans, actually. Worked offshore myself, talking about Aberdeen.
I worked offshore as a youngster for one 3 or 4 month period. Okay, I know exactly how terrible that work is. Okay.
Well, I was in the North Sea, so I spent many...
Yeah, I had a chance to go from working offshore to working in Alaska in Prudhoe Bay, and I said, I am not that great. I don't care how good the money is. We're off the subject here in Wage World, but that's Wage World. You know, and it was more money at that time than I could imagine. I would have been able to pay for... all 4 years of college and university for what they were willing to pay me if I was willing to be there for 3 or 4 months. And I just, you know, I mean, I might still have frostbite from my tip of my hand to the tip of my nose. I just could, but the North Sea is every bit as bad as Alaska, isn't it?
It can be. Obviously, it's salt water, so you don't get much frozen water, I suppose, or the kind of extreme colds you get kind of more wet cold, if that makes sense. But
sure, hypothermia is just right next door to you every minute.
Aye,
but that's the same thing in Prudhoe Bay. It's out in salt water.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
My
but the snow and ice and still, I mean, working offshore, even in the summertime, which is when I'd worked offshore, if it rained, you're talking about, you know, being on top of tanks that are all oiled up and greased up, like, you know, a greased pig, and it rains or whatever, you can fall off at any moment and be dead that second. So, I mean, put you know, 5 degrees, 0 degrees or whatever, and sleet and whatever.
That was a wonderful time, man.
It's a wonderful thing, but no amount of money is how, you know.
Well, so that's exactly the point that I would make. So, like I said, you'd maybe call it a blue-collar family. I was told to get a trade rather than do further education. I did travel a lot through my teenage years, right through my 20s. And I don't get me wrong, it was more money. I was always told that offshore, the oil and gas was the epitome of your trade. That was the highest level. And I reached it maybe too soon, and I wasn't prepared for the money particularly. I wasn't prepared for the lifestyle at that age either.
Right.
And it was that time walking away from home, I seen how other people were living that were maybe twice my age, and they didn't look happy. They were maybe wealthy and they didn't look happy. I tried to use a lot of my earnings at the time to help my family through and kind of pay off their mortgage and stuff, but I never felt contented. And over the last 4 or 5 years, particularly during the Scottish independence referendum, as many young people did in Scotland, a kind of political enlightenment, if you want to call it something as such, like that, I did experience a real kind of change mentally, and I wanted to try and be content, obviously, in your own life, but also try something different and see how you can
make a difference.
The world. Aye, may impact the world and kind of create something change. We talk about oil and gas, we talk about this, but there's an interesting stat that more money has been through Aberdeen in the last 30, 40 years than has been through Dubai. And if you ever look at pictures of Dubai and look at pictures of Aberdeen Main Street, or the transport, or the living conditions of people even in Aberdeen, it's absolutely chalk and cheese. And that makes you think, what's the underlying issue? What's the problem there? Why is so much money went through this place? And it's an absolute tip at times.
I hear you. We're talking to Sean Bailey, who both lives and works in Glasgow, and he's directing the Living Rent campaign on the staff side in Glasgow. So you were talking about the Scottish independence movement. The election did not succeed in terms of those people who supported independence, but at the same time, it did force the British government to devolve, as they said, some powers to. And I think the housing campaign that Living Rent has run, they've taken advantage of that devolution to try to win more than they might normally have been able to win from the Scottish Parliament. Is that your experience, Sean?
I'd say that was mostly true, yes. The Scottish Parliament had devolved powers going back to the late 1990s. There was powers, increased devolved powers promised from the referendum that never materialised, but it's going to be another conversation for another day.
That's longer than a half-hour show, probably, yeah.
But the particular, I think, political environment that the referendum created had a massive impact on like Living Rent, the creation of Living Rent, the campaign it ran, and the private tenancy bill that was passed in late 2015, introduced in 2016. It was definitely gave it the political impetus. It also gathered a lot of support, and that kind of feeling that normal people could affect change, and that we wanted to do it to improve our lives as such. So that was the essential kind of ingredients of that campaign and what it achieved from the independence referendum. It was a lot of people that were enthused and brought into politics, I suppose, through the referendum campaign. They got heavily involved in the Living Rent campaign afterwards.
So a lot of that energy carried over into this fight. Now, when you talk about having won something in security of tenure, in the U.S. that would be called a lease. That was not common in Scotland, that you could get a long-term lease for your housing to protect your rent. That's not something a lot of people listening to you will understand. So tell people why the security of tenure was so important.
It was massively important. So beforehand, we would have what was called maybe a short assured tenancy. These would be restricted and limited to 6 or 12 months. And thereafter, you would be on a rolling month-to-month contract. So the insecurity came with that, not knowing month-to-month if the landlord just decided they didn't want you, wanted to sell, they wanted you to move out, wanted to get someone else in that he preferred, his friends, family, or just wanted to put the rent up. Or even if you wanted...
Because they could raise the rent at any time on a month-to-month extension.
Yeah, so it was a rolling contract, so every month you were essentially breaking that contract and starting a new one. There was also... If you complained or requested simple repairs or the likes, they would be, they could easily be like, no fault eviction. They could move you out as soon as they wanted more within a month.
No fault eviction. Okay, that's a concept that's hard to wring your mind around. No fault eviction. Like, why would you evict somebody unless they were at fault? is the way most tenants would see it anyway. So when people started demanding that they wanted more security of tenure, what were they trying to get and what did they end up winning?
What they were trying to get was, we did achieve a lot of what they set out to achieve at first. So in regards to security of tenure, what we now have is an indefinite tenancy. So if you sign a lease, it's not for a fixed term period, it is for an indefinite period, as long as you kind of keep to the conditions of the contract. There is now, we've scrapped the no fault eviction, so there's no, we can't just get rid of you if they like. They now have to prove one of 18 clauses that are written into the contract.
18 clauses? So wow.
There's still 18 faults, 18 reasons that you can be evicted, but each one of them range from what you'd maybe expect if you don't pay your rent for 3 or more consecutive months is one. But they range
not paying rent for 4 consecutive months.
Yeah.
That's a pretty serious non-payment there.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty fair, it seems like.
I suppose you could yeah. You can see the sense.
You didn't just forget
clause.
That month. Not when it runs 4 months, yeah.
But there's also ranges to quite the ridiculous kind of things, such as maybe they want to convert the flat into a place of religious worship. It's not to say religion's ridiculous, but it seems like a very extreme excuse to make to get rid of someone to the flat.
Right.
There's also other things that if they have to move into the flat themselves, or a family member wants to say, oh, my nephew's coming up, he wants to stay, they have to prove that they're going to stay there for three, they are going to stay in the tenancy for 3 or more consecutive months as well.
Oh, okay.
So there's a lot of kind of things that they have to prove to get you out, but it's
so
still,
that gives tenants a lot more protection.
Absolutely.
Anything move forward in terms of keeping the rents down, or did y'all have, I know rent control is something that we've talked to people about on Wage World recently in a lot of different contexts, but did y'all, I know originally it sounded like y'all won something significant in rent control. Why don't you explain, because I've touted this whole area plan as a huge Scotland advance, so it's been sort of depressing hearing that this may have not quite been what we'd hoped, but tell people what we thought we were winning, what we've got, and what situation we're in, Sean.
So we thought we'd won something massive, and on paper, at a quick glance, it did look huge. It was touted by the Scottish National Party and the Scottish Government as this really progressive, forward-thinking policy. What it's turned out to be is
what did they call this?
It was a rent pressure zone.
Rent pressure zones, which is a creative way of looking at it. Okay, so you could, it wasn't citywide necessarily, although I think we tried to get it citywide.
So it was a complete kind of fudge at times. What a rent pressure zone does is gives the citywide local authorities the powers to request powers to implement this on any area that they can prove the rent is increasing too fast or has a detrimental effect on the local community.
So it would particularly in a smaller geography than just sort of the whole city of Glasgow, like in gentrification, that would, if you had an area that you could tell was rapidly gentrifying, that would seem to be tailor-made for a rent pressure zone.
Absolutely. You could narrow it down and separate it by postcode, I guess, or a kind of zip code, and it could be very specific, but also what that might engineer is just shifting the problem from one neighbourhood to the next.
Which is why y'all wanted citywide.
Yeah.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you. We're just trying to explain to people.
Of course.
But when we've talked to them about citywide or anything else, they've sort of drugged their feet in terms of actually determining a pressure zone. Is that right? Or
Yeah, so the kind of stipulations that you need to meet or the criteria that they've set out that we need to, the local authority or ourselves or anyone we need to provide and kind of show evidence of is completely at the minute unobtainable. So we did a kind of drive to launch Living Rent in Glasgow. The first full meeting we had, the campaign was voted on that we were going to pursue this rent pressure zone to the local authority. There was city councillors in the meeting. They went away before we could build a campaign, and within a month they'd agreed that they'd commission a feasibility study, they called it.
Okay.
As time went on and we looked further into it, and word was getting back to us that in order to prove that this was needed, they needed data that did not exist. So they could not, there is no single body, there is no database or no registry of rent increases anywhere in Scotland.
And so they're trying to say they can't make a decision because they don't have enough information from the data that they're supposed to keep.
Yeah, so
they're not sure they're supposed to keep it. Is that what they're trying to say?
Yeah, so they're saying the only place they would get this data would be from landlords and letting agents, estate agents themselves, and they said that they would either be uncooperative or it would leave them open to legal challenge, I think was the exact wording.
That sounds a little far-fetched, legal challenge, but okay, I hear you. So they've sort of got you in a perfect circle around your neck, making it hard to pursue.
Yeah, I think there is.
So what's the strategy now to get through that? Try to get an amendment of some kind? Or I know earlier today I heard you talking about they don't have a lot of stomach for dealing with housing now. They sort of think, okay, check that box. We're going on now to other issues in the Parliament.
Yeah, it's the whole independence movement's died down a wee bit, and there's not as much political pressure, I suppose, on the Scottish Government. They feel as if it's put in the bag, and particularly they think that they've done enough on housing. I could go to other aspects where I can prove they're not, but maybe for another conversation.
We've got several times you and I are going to have a number of part one, part two, part three Sean Bailey interviews. We'll have a whole series, the Sean Bailey series. Go ahead.
Yeah, but in terms of trying to open the legislation up for secondary amendments, which city councillors and members of parliament and within the SNP have stated they're going to push, but the SNP is a political party, is very controlled, very managed. But the easiest way would be to open the two fronts, in my opinion, would be open the legislation for secondary amendments to allow the creation of some sort of national lease registry that would basically record every new lease, would record the rent, but also.
And that's just good public policy, regardless of pressure zones. I mean, if you don't have a registry, how do they get tax money? How do they determine unlawful habitation? Everything you're talking about. That's a good idea, Sean.
That's exactly what I'm trying to push for, because it would make your life so much easier on a whole host of fronts, for enforcement, on things that are legal fees, for repairs, for taxis, absolutely everything. So it seems a bit ridiculous that this doesn't exist already, in my opinion. So
you'd think the authority, and we talk about the authority, we're really talking about a branch of the council, the city council, right, for Edinburgh? Or is it a separate, independent authority?
To create a change in legislation?
No, the body that would determine a rent pressure zone.
So it would be the city authority?
It would be the city. So that would be the authority there. It would be the city council, essentially. Because in the United States, for example, and in some places in Canada, the Housing Authority for Public Housing is a branch sort of more connected to the federal government,
right,
because it's funded by the federal government than it is the local city council. So, but in the Glasgow context, it's right there where you've got pressure you can put on people. It's your city council person who's taking care of the housing. Is not taking care of the housing in this case.
Absolutely. It's them that are coming back and saying that they have no other option. But in terms of enforcement on a whole number of fronts, Glasgow City Council, which traditionally was maybe a Labour city, had a strong public sector, has been decimated and privatised beyond belief. There's a skeleton infrastructure within the civil service. So we'll talk about enforcement for even building and planning regulations and repairing standard. There is only two people employed across the city. One focuses full time on a square mile, the other works part time for the rest of the city.
That's like no enforcement at all. I mean,
well, there's one enforcement is living rent. That's what it's turned out to be for the last year or so.
It's one of those where who's in charge and you're speaking. You know, it's me. It's Sean Bailey from Living Rent. You know, volunteer city employee on inspection zones. But we were looking at a housing regulation in Detroit that seemed to be perfect on this campaign you heard us describing about predatory lending. And it required, though, that you had to prove the housing was habitable. And, of course, Detroit has been broke as a joke.
Oh, yep.
There's no inspectors. So it didn't matter how well the law read, nobody was there to enforce it. It was just sort of like me standing on a bridge yelling, "You're breaking all, you know, who would care?" I mean, it's sort of, we're talking to Sean Bailey about a great campaign that he and others have been directing in Scotland called Living Rent. I like the name Living Rent. You know, we ran campaigns called Living Wages around the same thing, that you had to have a wage that made it possible to live. And that's the same kind of, you had to have a rent level that doesn't take 80% of your income, as you were describing, for people paying minimum wage. So where do we go now, Sean? This is not a happy story we're telling people. We've held Scotland up as the model, and now I'm like breaking hearts all over the listenership here. But what's going on now in terms of Living Rent? What are we looking at?
Well, a wider picture quickly, I think that we are ahead of the game in a lot of ways. So the housing situation in Glasgow and Scotland is particularly bad, but we look a couple hundred miles south and it's maybe not the same extremes as London. So if we are looking to have a positive impact on our futures and the future of the housing and affordable living in Scotland, I think we need to grow the strength and capacity and density of our campaign, our union. So at the minute, we've launched successfully as a citywide organisation in Glasgow, and over the next year we'll be looking to have a greater kind of density within local neighbourhoods, a more grassroots focus, or grassroots run, but a real kind of street by street focus. And a lot of the issues that we're coming across, we're looking to have local leaders and local teams that each street, each neighbourhood can defend themselves at first. So if they're organised to defend themselves, their neighbours, their community, they can then be on the front foot when times are starting to really ramp up and get tough, as we expect, and they can actually go on the attack, I suppose, for want of a better word, and start to really make massive improvements in life. But I think we need to learn. In a city that's also been, it's seen two or three cycles of regeneration, they call it, which is basically destruction. They've moved and smashed communities.
We love the term regeneration. That's such a fake term. Oh. I had to explain that to so many people. Regeneration? What are they talking about? Well, they're talking about, development. That's just, this is not regeneration. It's like, this is not somebody being born. This is something being destroyed. Gotcha.
And we've got a member in Glasgow who calls, he's combined regeneration and gentrification into the one term of social cleansing. So a city that's seen massive changes, but the social housing is smashed, but also what they've done is they've in different cycles moved people from the city centres further and further to the periphery. Yeah. Mm-hmm. New build or new developments, they have no transport, no jobs. It's a similar story, I imagine, across the world. We need to try and sense, so we've got families and social units maybe that have been smashed through that, so part of your job is to make neighbours talk to each other again. Part of the good thing about the new private tenancy that we won, the indefinite tenancy, it means that we'll be able to create roots in communities again, because people were very transient. So
gotcha.
A lot of our members maybe had to move 10 times in 5 years.
Well, you're doing the work, and we're so proud of Living Rent as an affiliate of Acorn International. But tell people how they can get in touch with you or find out more or send money or do whatever. We've only got a minute left, but give people a website or whatever you got, Sean.
The best place you can get in touch for more information, keep in touch with your campaigns, is www.livingrent.org. You'll be able to donate through that page, find our campaigns. You'll also be able to email me through that. If not, my email is sean.bailey@livingrent.org. So it's sean.bailie.
That's BAILLIE. I had to ask Sean, how do you pronounce that? Because I didn't want to like make a big mistake on Wage World here, and it's Bailey. He said, don't you know Bailey's? Well, sure, I know Bailey's, but is that spelled that way? So that'll help you remember, BAILLIES.@livingrent.org, right?
Yep, that's okay. The one. Perfect.
Okay, thank you so much, Sean. And as you already heard, we'll have part two and part three coming sometime over the next year or two. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we have another guest, this is Wade Rathke for Wade's World. See, that was painless.
It was fine.
Okay, you off? I thought you already told me you were leaving.
This program is produced by the Arkansas Broadcasting Foundation, KABF-FM in Little Rock, Arkansas, and is distributed through Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, serving the needs and interests of low and moderate income Americans.